Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Mr. Marshall, will you please introduce the case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Jessen, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case 821-0467, Charles Earl Strother versus State of Minnesota.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is our final oral argument for the morning. We will follow the ordinary rules as if we were in person. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. And introduce yourselves at the beginning of your argument. The hearings are being recorded and will be posted on our website. Are you ready to begin, Mr. Nguyen?
I am, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed then.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Christopher Nguyen, and I represent the appellant Charles Earl Strother in his matter on an appeal from denial of post-conviction relief. On March 2nd, 2021, the Honorable Patrick Rowland issued the court's response to appellant's petition for post-conviction relief pursuant to the Minnesota Post-Conviction Act. In the district court's order, the court cites 7 conclusions of law in its denial of the petition, and in its order, the court claims the issues raised by the appellant are barred under NAFLA. The primary argument is an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim, and the specific issues appellant's counsel failed to make during the direct appeal constitute the ineffective assistance, and where the district court finds any such arguments are waived under NAFLA, such findings and determinations only serve to strengthen the appellant's argument that they should have been raised on appeal and were therefore inadvertently missed, a fact that the district court could have ascertained more fully should have permitted an evidentiary hearing.
As the district- I just want to make sure that I understand your argument. It wasn't clear to me from your briefs whether or not the arguments that you presented, for instance, the admission of the expert testimony and those arguments, were those standalone arguments? Are they the basis for your relief, or are they subsets of your ineffective assistance of appellate counsel?
So, Your Honor, the failure to raise those arguments, not only are they standalone arguments for why Mr. Strother is due post-conviction relief, but they would also fall underneath an umbrella were the court not to find that they were sufficient in and of themselves, part of a cumulative error argument, Your Honor. As a district court has done, I'd ask that this court be magnanimous and assume the arguments were inadvertently missed by appellate counsel, where the district court had also done so and provided us the performance prong. We can then go into the prejudice prong. And so I'll begin with the expert witness, the issues surrounding the certification as an expert, and then into the substantive testimony. And from there, I'll address sufficiency of the evidence should our time permit. So let's see. So the pretrial order dated January 12th, 2018, places limits on the expert witness's testimony consistent with OBETA and permits provisionally the following types of testimony: intimate partner type rape, submissive behaviors in rape victims, and other counterintuitive victim behaviors. The expert is asked 48 questions on her background, knowledge, skills, and experience, is then certified, and then asked another 39 on her substantive knowledge after certification by the district court. On the original 48 questions, what we learned from the record is that the witness received a general degree in social work without any concentrations or specializations, has worked for 20 years as she states, an advocate for victims of domestic and sexual assault, has not conducted any formal research on victims of domestic or sexual assault, but has published 2 books, one on healing from trauma and another entitled Why She Stays, which the witness states is based on her interactions with clients. And these can be found on page 10 from the trial on the January 18th, 2018 transcript. The state then enters her resume. It's not a CV, but a resume. And notwithstanding the value, the concern, or care that the witness provides her clients, her qualifications simply do not arise to a level of expert, as expert witnesses and their testimony are required to provide a degree of foundational reliability that goes beyond a mere helpfulness standard. And it is a concept that looks to the theories and methodologies used by an expert. And that is directly from State v. Garland, 942 Northwest 2D 732. The standard for qualifying an expert under 702 was not met in the instant case. And because the expert should not have been qualified due to the lack of foundational reliability, the court abused its discretion in denying appellant's petition for post-conviction relief because the expert simply didn't have the foundational reliability within her testimony. And I'll follow up with what some of those.
Also, we rely on experience as much or more than training when we're evaluating an expert, don't we?
You know, Your Honor, I would absolutely concede that experience is absolutely relevant. However,
she had a lot of it.
Your Honor, I would say that the expert's experience in the instant case would not necessarily be any different than that what a law enforcement officer would find in their interactions with a witness. And so, because we're talking about somebody who's in a role of being approached by victims of sexual assault, assuming that they are in fact victims of sexual assault, and providing them assistance, that doesn't necessarily put them in a position to say that what the behaviors are of victims, what their needs are, and maybe make inferences given like extrapolation of data. What are the methodologies? What is the scientific community that's used? What's the body of knowledge from which she draws her conclusions? And if we look closely at the record, her testimony does not provide anything that would suggest that there is a shared body of knowledge within her area of expertise from which she draws her testimony. And Your Honor, I touch on that more thoroughly here as I get into what some of her substantive testimony is. And so as a theme, the witness's experiences are consistent with someone who possesses anecdotal interactions, regardless of their frequency, with people who inform the witness that they are victims of sexual assault. And this is distinguished from someone whom we would expect to serve as an expert witness who would possess the foundational knowledge on the statistics used in the field, measurements, what measurements are used and why. Or more pointedly, again, foundational reliability. So the following...
Isn't that the difference between book smarts and street smarts? And don't we like street smarts?
Your Honor, I certainly do appreciate somebody that has street smarts and experience. But when we talk about street smarts, Your Honor, what I would say is that these are things that we would expect of a lay witness given a certain amount of time. And certainly we would have a higher standard than mere helpfulness or an understanding that a lay person would have been able to receive through simple, just solely experience. A couple of the examples that I'll give, she's asked, is there some magic point that triggers each victim to leave? Do domestic assault victims assess a risk associated with leaving or calling law enforcement? Her testimony is then that victims are seven times more likely to be murdered when attempting to leave a relationship. And that can be found on page 24, paragraph 13 of the January 18th, 2018 trial. She provides some anecdotal quotes of conversations that she has had with some of her clients. She's asked, are there any statistics about how many times it takes a victim to be assaulted before a victim leaves? And she states, we know it usually takes seven, but she doesn't provide who we are. Again, what is the body of knowledge that we're drawing the inferences, the information, the data from? Ask, do you see any other issues with sexual assault victims? And her response is, at some point in time, they decided, I can't get out of this. So if I submit, it will just go by more quickly. And I can just forget about this and just chalk it up to this is something that happened to me and go on with my life. And so sometimes people will take that track of, well, I'm just going to let whatever's happening happen and get out of this as quickly as I can. And Your Honor, the concern that I have for statements such as this is, you know, again, going back to the specific subsegment of the quote, if I submit, and this outward manifestation of behavior could absolutely be perceived as consent by the accused. And so if there's an outward manifestation of consent, what it seems the expert is saying is that even if the victim had consented, it is still not consensual. And it's this kind of testimony that prejudices the defendant and further goes to raising the credibility of the alleged victim, which is not something that is permissible under 702.
What do we do with the fact that your client in his pro se brief and the underlying appeal raised the issue about this expert and the court addressed it at length in the earlier decision?
So, Your Honor, I can see that this court did address it to some capacity in my client's direct appeal. However, what I would say is that the way I interpreted this court's ruling at that time was kind of to be the bright line rule of saying they are the witness herself was not suggesting that it is 97% likely that the victim is telling the truth, and I don't think that the court is wrong. I don't ask that the court re-review that necessarily with regard to finding that it wasn't a statistical finding as to whether or not the defendant had committed the crime. However, I do think that the court did not address whether or not such testimony served to support the alleged victim's testimony underneath a 608. And of course, that would be an inappropriate raising or supporting of the alleged victim's testimony. And so that would have been improper. And this court did not address that finding more conclusively in its ruling. On cross-examination, the expert witness was asked one question and one question alone. And that was, isn't it true on occasions people who make reports of sexual and domestic assault aren't telling the truth? A simple yes or no question. And her response was, yes, I think the FBI reports it at 3%. Again, without any foundational reliability toward giving that number. And so, you know, I would also point out that while the court wasn't necessarily required to, there was no limiting instruction that that the court gave the jury. And so what I would anticipate the jury hearing from an expert witness is she says that they're telling the truth. The FBI agrees that that more likely than not, she's telling the truth, or at least the FBI agrees that when victims raise the issue, most of the time they're telling the truth. And that's completely improper. And those are the concerns that I think the Saldana court had in kind of providing like the hammer rule and not carving out the exception for the idea that an expert witness could be used, but it has to be careful. Done in consideration of the rights of the accused. And I think that the
Saldana has been clarified by the Obetta case.
Agreed, Your Honor. Agreed. And I think that in practice, what has happened though is that the lack of preparation for ensuring that the questions are narrowly tailored towards those things that are permissible under Obetta isn't always happening. And it certainly didn't happen here, Your Honor. And so, because the record demonstrates that this expert shouldn't have been able to testify, and should not have been certified, and even if this court does find that she could have been certified, the testimony itself was improper and outside of the scope of what's permissible under Obetta, the district court abused its discretion in allowing the testimony, or at the very least, in not fixing the record or instructing the jury to limit the testimony that came in at trial. I have nothing further to add at this point.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Nguyen.
Thank you.
Attorney for respondent, you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Will Lundy. I am a law student practitioner under the supervision of Special Assistant Redwood County Attorney Travis Smith, and I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. In the end, I think this is a very simple case. There's really only one question before the court, and that is whether or not the post-conviction court abused its discretion when it denied the petition for post-conviction relief here without a hearing. As this court is aware, all of the issues that appellant raises now would typically be Knopfler barred. These were issues that were either raised or known about and not raised, or should have been raised at the time of his direct appeal, and Knopfler prevents defendants from raising those on post-conviction relief.
But you would agree that you can't raise ineffective assistance of appellate counsel at that point.
That's in some cases, Your Honor, and I'm going to get to that in just in a minute. I think the answer to that is, where a defendant like appellant here writes a pro se supplemental brief, I think it is possible that Knopfler might bar ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, because in writing a pro se supplemental brief, the appellant is expressing dissatisfaction with his attorney's performance and sort of implicitly saying, my appellate attorney's performance is ineffective. So if you can raise all of these issues that you want to raise in a petition for post-conviction, on a pro se supplemental brief, there's really no reason why a person couldn't also raise an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim at that point as well. And so potentially those could be Knopfler barred. But where I want to go with this is even if it's not Knopfler barred, as an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim, the only way to get relief here is to accurately and appropriately plead the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. And counsel for appellant has insisted that any errors here were inadvertent, but simply failing to raise the issues that he raises now, the Supreme Court has been very clear in Chavez-Nelson that simply failing to raise these issues is not enough. He has to argue affirmatively that appellate counsel improperly concluded that waived or unraised arguments would be unsuccessful on appeal. In short, he has to prove that his appellate attorney could not have reasonably concluded that these arguments would be unsuccessful. Appellant did not, at the district court, raise any allegation that his appellate attorney considered these issues and then subsequently wrongly concluded that they would be unsuccessful on appeal. And absent that kind of a pleading, there's really no need for an evidentiary ruling or an evidentiary hearing, because he has failed to plead ineffective assistance of appellate counsel correctly. In short, it's like a probable cause in omnibus hearing or a 12B6 motion. He's failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And based on that, I think, in Chavez-Nelson, I can't say it any better than the court did there. Even if the alleged facts and in his petition for post-conviction relief, appellant alleged only that counsel for appellant had called his appellate attorney and she said, sure, maybe I missed something. But that by itself is inadequate to establish the first prong of Strickland in the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. And therefore, appellant isn't conclusively entitled to no relief, because the failure to raise the correct arguments doesn't by itself, satisfy the first requirement of Strickland. And accordingly, I would ask that this court affirm the district court and affirm appellant's convictions. As to appellant's arguments with regard to the expert witness. First of all, I want to kind of touch on what Judge Kirk was talking about earlier. The expert witness, Ms. Staub-Absher, had 20 years of experience working with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Yes, she had a bachelor's degree in social work and women's studies, and she had published these two books. She was a member of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women and the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She had conducted over 500 hours of training on domestic and sexual assaults and had testified as an expert on these issues in four previous criminal trials. In short, if Ms. Staub-Absher was not qualified to testify as an expert, essentially, appellant's argument is reading the experience element of, out of Rule 702. Essentially, if she's not qualified, I'm not sure that really anyone is. As to his other arguments about, you know, about the expert testimony, first of all, as Judge Riley noted, appellant did raise the broad claim of the admissibility of the expert witness's testimony in his pro se supplemental brief. And the Supreme Court has held that where a defendant raises such an issue in a pro se supplemental brief, that issue essentially can't be part of an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim simply because he wasn't prejudiced by his attorney's failure to raise it. He raised it himself. Secondly, I do think that the Supreme Court's decision in Obeda fundamentally answers the question that we have here. In Obeda, the Supreme Court said that because the mental and physical reactions of an adult sexual assault victim may be outside the common understanding of an average juror, expert testimony of typical behaviors by adult sexual assault victims may be helpful to the jury in evaluating the evidence in a particular case. And that is exactly what happened here. It's the kind of testimony that that the district court permitted Staub-Absher to testify to, and it's the kind of testimony that she gave. And so under Rule 702, contrary to appellant's argument, this testimony was admissible. And, you know, it's not as though, frankly, the Supreme Court's decision in Obeda kind of, I think, eliminates any problem with this kind of testimony. I think appellant's argument kind of hits on a Fry Mac sort of analysis, and you know, whether or not there's a you know, what the scientific community believes about these things, whether that's clear or not, those kinds of issues. And I think Obeda, just as a matter of law, says stands for the proposition that this kind of testimony in the appropriate case, which this is admissible. So, you know, as to his arguments, I'm going to keep going. If the court has questions, by all means, ask. Otherwise, I'm going to have to keep talking to you, I'm afraid. But as to appellant's argument under Rule 403, again, I think Obeda answers this question. You know, Rule 403 talks about unfair prejudice or unfair, and you know, whether or not evidence is admissible if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. You know, and this court has held that, you know, the unfair prejudice is an unfair advantage that results from the capacity of the evidence to persuade by illegitimate means. But because the Obeda court held that this kind of testimony is admissible, I think the means of persuasion there are indeed legitimate. You know, and then moving on to what is ultimately, I think, appellant's Rule 608 argument about vouching and those kinds of issues. You know, this court did hold on direct appeal that Ms. Staub-Absher did not say anything about the victim's truthfulness. The expert's testimony wasn't offered to bolster the victim's credibility, but instead to provide the jury with helpful background information about counterintuitive behaviors commonly displayed by sexual assault victims, just as Obeda, you know, permits. So really, Rule 608 simply doesn't have any application here. And then, you know, this court did rule on the question of, you know, the comment about 3% of victims. This court ruled on this in the direct appeal. This court's ruling is now law of the case, and I don't think appellant can complain about that issue at this point. So in short, with regard to the expert witness's testimony, it was first of all, the expert witness's testimony was admissible, and therefore there was no reason for appellant's appellate attorney to raise the question of the admissibility of Ms. Staub-Absher's testimony. Therefore, her performance didn't fall below an objective standard of reasonableness. And as to appellant's cumulative error argument, I think that is pretty clear as well, simply because he alleges the single error of prosecutorial misconduct that this court found on direct appeal and wants to combine that with the other errors he alleges here. And perhaps he can clarify on rebuttal exactly what he's talking about. But the only error that I can see that could possibly sort of compound with the prosecutorial misconduct would be Ms. Staub-Absher's testimony, because and that's an evidentiary ruling, and the remedy for cumulative error and the remedy for, you know, a real abuse of discretion under, you know, under the expert witness testimony question would be a new trial. But the other arguments that he makes about the sufficiency of the evidence and cruel and unusual punishment, those kinds of things, those have very different remedies. And I don't think they can really be classified as trial errors such that they can compound and make a cumulative error argument. And I've tried to interpret his brief so that they didn't, you know, make that argument. I'd rather try to interpret it in such a way that, you know, so that we could analyze the substance of the claims. But in any event, because Ms. Staub-Absher's testimony was admissible, there's no error to accumulate, and the cumulative error argument would ultimately have failed as well. And again, appellate counsel did not act unprofessionally by failing to raise that argument. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, again, I don't believe that can be part of a cumulative error challenge, because if this court were to find that the evidence was genuinely insufficient, the remedy would be reversal of the conviction rather than a new trial. Appellant makes two arguments about this. Both of them involve statutory interpretation. As an initial point on that factor, neither this court nor the Minnesota Supreme Court has ever definitively interpreted the first-degree witness tampering statute, and accordingly, any interpretation of that statute would constitute an issue of first impression. And it seems very odd to imagine that an appellate attorney would be unconstitutionally ineffective for failing to raise an issue of first impression. In any event, appellant argues that he can't be guilty of aggravated witness tampering because the victim called the police, but the aggravated witness tampering statute criminalizes not only actually preventing or dissuading a person from calling the police, but attempting to prevent or dissuade. So the statute explicitly envisions cases where the victim does in fact call for law enforcement, and the threat of bodily harm or death does not effectively prevent him or her from doing so. So I think that argument fails. Second, he argues that he can't have committed the witness tampering because the evidence shows that he committed a crime against the victim only after he made the threats. First of all, in my review of the record, I think that's factually false. First of all, the victim unequivocally withdrew consent during sex before appellant threatened her. And you can find that on pages 112 to 113 of the trial transcript, the first transcript. And appellant was doing drugs in the victim's house before he threatened her. Both of those are crimes. And so the threat happened after that. Second, it fails legally simply because section 609.498 does not contemplate the timing of a threat vis-a-vis the criminal activity involved. Accordingly, appellant's appellate attorney was not ineffective for failing to raise that argument. Finally, with regard to cruel or unusual punishment, I have not found a single case where any court has ever held that a sentence which of itself is concededly not cruel or unusual is somehow rendered cruel or unusual because the prosecutor offered a lighter sentence during the plea negotiations. Evidence from the plea negotiations wouldn't be admissible at trial anyway. And it has really has no bearing on what the actual penalty is. Here, the appellant received a Minnesota sentencing guideline sentence that is presumptively reasonable, is presumptively legal, and appellant has not made any claim to the contrary. With that, I would simply ask this court to affirm appellant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nguyen, do you have any rebuttal?
Some, Your Honor, yes. So with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence claim, and in particular, as it relates to witness tampering, in the opening arguments, the state informed the jury that the defendant threatened to kill her or her children if they told anyone. And you can see that on day one of trial, January 16th, page 89, lines 11 and 12. Elsie states that she says to appellant, if he's going to kill her, then to do it in the garage where the boys don't have to see. This is contrasted from, I will kill you if you tell anyone. And is also in the context that at the time, the defendant allegedly being upset about someone tampering with his vehicle. Want to be clear that this is not in the context whatsoever of a predicate crime. And so if he were to have been charged, say, with terroristic threats or something to that extent, that would have been different. But what he didn't do was say, if you tell anyone, I will kill you. And so I would have this court note that on sufficiency of the evidence claims, I would anticipate that this court would be going through the record quite thoroughly. And so what we see is in that direct examination of the alleged victim, LC, what we see is a lot of.
I've never seen a case where this court has weighed the sufficiency of the evidence in a post-conviction setting. That typically is in a direct appeal setting. Can you point me to cases where a post-conviction court has reweighed the trial evidence with regard to sufficiency of it?
I do not have a citation for you, Your Honor. And if the court would like, I'd be more than happy to provide a supplemental brief should there be anything available.
We can look for it ourselves, but I am unfamiliar with that body of case law.
So I would just have this court note that the way in which the examination occurs with the alleged victim is there is a lot of close-ended questions, leading questions that are on the victim. And it happens repeatedly and regularly. And unfortunately, it is not objected to. And this court has already found that there was not an effective assistance of trial counsel. But the way in which this testimony comes in that ends up resulting in my client's conviction is done in such a way that the vast majority of that testimony is coming in through the advocate and not from the witness. And if they're going to say that that my client had at that time done a crime that is consistent with third degree murder with regard to severity, that should have been something that came through from the victim herself. And the record doesn't show that. What the record shows is that the advocate says it and that the witness simply confirms it. And that doesn't seem to fit the bill for how that evidence should have came into trial. And I think that that is concerning. There are numerous instances that this court, I'm sure, will find in the process of reviewing the record. I would have this court note that even if it is the case where it is unlikely to, say, vacate the sentence for CSC, because we can, I think, admit that or we'd concede that the jury found the witness credible, at least credible enough to convict him of the CSC. My client is currently incarcerated, not because of the CSC, but is currently incarcerated due to the first degree witness tampering. And that crime should have been committed in contemplation of the predicate crime. We don't see that when we look at the record there is confusion, not just that there is confusion by the witness, by the advocates, and even the court itself in trying to identify when it was that the witness tampering actually occurred. And that is something that can be seen in these sentencing hearings. And for that reason, at a minimum, I would ask that this court vacate the conviction for first degree witness tampering and order a new trial.
Thank you. Thank you for your briefs and your arguments. The case is now submitted.